it's kind of worrisome. You don't know what you're breathing, and it seems like it's coming up into the neighborhoods.
Some cruise ships have not been up to par when it comes to air quality standards. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 13th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, after a week's searching for a missing Kotzebue girl, authorities have shifted their focus to investigation.
There could be criminal activity involved in Ashley's disappearance. It could be just a tragic accident. Law enforcement is trying to pursue all of the leads.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Starting October 1st, all of Alaska will be protected from the harmful effects of secondhand smoke because all public places across the state will be smoke-free. Everyone can now breathe easier as they work and play. Smoke-free workplaces and public spaces protects the health of all Alaskans. It also protects our youth from ever starting smoking. So if you do smoke or vape, please take it outside. For more information about the new smoke-free workplace law, visit smokefree.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Department of Health and Social Services.
Senator Lisa Murkowski still isn't saying how she'll vote on the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. Waves of Alaskans, sponsored by groups that want to preserve abortion rights and the Affordable Care Act, have flown to Washington, D.C. to urge her to vote no on Kavanaugh. Yesterday, they were joined by a powerful voice in the state, the Alaska Federation of Natives. With us to discuss this is Alaska Public Media's Washington correspondent, Liz Ruskin. Hi, Liz.
Hey, Casey.
Liz, how significant is it that AFN wrote Murkowski a letter urging her to vote no on Kavanaugh?
AFN doesn't usually weigh in like this, so I'm sure it got her attention. But will it determine how she'll vote on its own? Probably not. She says she's going over everything Kavanaugh's written so that she can decide for herself and so she doesn't have to rely on other people telling her what he wrote. But AFN is an important constituency to her. In 2010, AFN was part of that massive effort to get her elected as a write-in.
What is AFN's reasoning in asking Murkowski to reject him?
It closely parallels a white paper that Heather Kendall Miller wrote. She's a Native American rights attorney. So their reasoning is very heavy on constitutional law, specifically about Congress's power to pass laws for the benefit of Indians. Kendall Miller recorded a radio ad for an anti-Kavanaugh group, and let's play a little bit of it.
Kavanaugh has a history of suggesting that Native Hawaiians shouldn't qualify for the same constitutional protections that lower 48 Indian tribes receive. If Kavanaugh believes the Native Hawaiians don't qualify for the same benefits and protections as other indigenous people, is there any question what he thinks about Alaska Natives?
Okay, if Kavanaugh believes that Native Hawaiians don't qualify for the same benefits and protections as other indigenous people, is there any question what he thinks about Alaska Natives? I mean, Liz, you got to unpack some of that.
So what we know about what Judge Kavanaugh thinks about Native Hawaiians comes from a 1999 op-ed he wrote. It was in the Wall Street Journal, and he was the co-author. But anyway, in this op-ed, Kavanaugh disputes that Native Hawaiians fit the definition of Indians as set out in the U.S. Constitution. Part of his argument is that they don't live on reservations. And according to his op-ed, if they're not Indians, as the Founding Fathers understood the term, any federal laws or programs that aim to improve the lot of Native Hawaiians are in danger of being judged as race-based privileges, just elevating one race over another, which would be unconstitutional. And the concern is that he would treat Alaska Natives as non-Indians, too, since the Constitution says nothing about, you know, Alaska Natives, and Alaska Natives don't live on reservations, most of them.
So what would be the effect of that?
According to Heather Kendall Miller, if Alaska Natives are no longer covered under the Indian umbrella, under the term as it's understood in the Constitution, the court could overturn most of the federal laws passed that help Alaska Natives. And she says it could even result in overturning the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act.
Wait, isn't that far-fetched? I mean, undo the 1971 settlement, dissolve the Native corporations?
I know it sounds far-fetched. I challenged one person who is raising this concern about Kavanaugh, and he said, yes, it does sound unlikely, but as he put it, things have been taken away from Native people since the country was founded.
That was Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin. Legal experts say the right for women to have an abortion is firmly protected by the Alaska Constitution, but it's become an issue in the election for governor. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman interviewed the candidates and has this report.
Governor Bill Walker recently wrote a commentary for the Anchorage Daily News saying that while he's pro-life, he would veto legislation seeking to restrict abortions.
My personal views haven't changed, but I will not put my personal views in front of the Constitution, which is extremely clear. Alaska has one of the strongest constitutions on, you know, personal individual rights, which includes a woman's reproductive rights. So that will remain unchanged in our administration.
Walker, who's an independent, says he supports other steps that he considers to be pro-life, like supporting access to birth control and health care.
And that's why I did what I did to accept Medicaid expansion. I knew I was going to, you know, be sued by some in the legislature. I was in the Senate majority. We prevailed in that litigation, and today 44,000 Alaskans have that coverage.
Walker says he would veto any bill restricting abortions. He expects the Attorney General would advise him that it's unconstitutional. But while the governor doesn't have a formal role in amending the Constitution, he's also skeptical of changing the Constitution to restrict abortions.
I'd have to see the amendment. You know, I have said I'm not I didn't run for governor. I'm not in this office to change anything the way it is today. And so I can't anticipate, you know, what an amendment would look like if it restricted it. I would not be in favor. We need to leave that issue. I'm not going to address that as governor because I think it's well settled.
Former U.S. Senator Mark Begich is the Democratic candidate. He says abortion rights are an issue this year.
I can tell you that I hear about it a lot. I'm the only candidate that's been endorsed by Planned Parenthood, the only candidate that has a 100% record when it comes to pro-choice issues and women's reproductive rights. And I think it will be an issue that women and men care about.
Begich acknowledges that the state constitution protects the right to an abortion, but he says the legislature can take other steps.
They'll whittle away in ways that you're right won't touch the constitutionality, but will do other things.
He cited a law Walker chose not to veto that allows school districts to prevent Planned Parenthood from providing sex education. And the Walker administration has defended another abortion-related law facing a legal challenge. This law makes it more difficult for Medicaid recipients to receive coverage for abortions. The legal challenge remains in court. And Begich says it's important for the Alaska governor to push back against any steps taken by the federal government to restrict abortions.
Even if we protect our right constitutionally for women's reproductive rights, we need to make sure the government on the federal end isn't passing some regulation that limits or restricts health care for women, and the governor has to be on the front line pushing back everywhere you can.
Republican candidate and former state senator Mike Dunleavy said in an interview last month he doesn't expect Alaska's abortion law to be affected by President Donald Trump's current choice for U.S. Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh.
The nomination of Kavanaugh, I don't think is going to change this dynamic. I could be wrong, but I'd be surprised if it did.
On a personal level, Dunleavy considers himself to be pro-life, including opposing abortion in cases of rape and incest.
The question for me is, should an innocent human being, should their life be ended because of circumstances? I struggle with that. I really do struggle with that. I don't think a person's life should be ended, an innocent human being's life should be ended, just because of the circumstances by which they were conceived or they're being carried to term.
Governors in other states have reshaped how state constitutions are interpreted through their choices of state Supreme Court justices. But in Alaska, the the process for selecting judges limits the governor's choices. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the state is having an oddly sunny September.
That's really, really remarkable. I mean, this is our wettest time of the year, and we would expect it to rain about 40% of the days.
That's Ask a Climatologist coming up. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
It's been a week since 10-year-old Ashley Johnson Barr went missing in Kotzebue, and the response is shifting from search and rescue to investigation. Alaska State Trooper spokesperson Jonathan Taylor says some search efforts will continue along shoreline and water access points, but the exhaustive nature of the multi-agency operation, the length of time that's passed, warrant transitioning the focus toward investigation,
including whether criminal activity may have been involved in her disappearance.
For now, Taylor says law enforcement, including the FBI, is not downsizing its presence in Kotzebue, and investigators are following up on information received from the public.
There could be criminal activity involved in Ashley's disappearance. It could be just a tragic accident. Law enforcement is trying to pursue all of the leads.
Taylor says forensics analysts in Anchorage are going through Johnson Barr's cell phone, which was found on a local street near Kotzebue Park where she was last seen September 6th. About 3,000 people live in the remote northwest Alaska coastal city, and Taylor says investigators believe someone knows what happened.
We're urging anyone who may have details or knowledge of Ashley's disappearance or current whereabouts to come forward with that information.
Taylor says a local call and text tip line has been set up, and anyone outside Kotzebue with information can call Alaska State Troopers. Imagine a wave as tall as the ConocoPhillips building in downtown Anchorage. It happened just 3 years ago in southeast Alaska. A new scientific paper makes the case that climate change could increase the likelihood of these events. Nat Herz with Alaska's Energy Desk has the story of what a ragtag crew of scientists learned when they descended on a remote fjord where the tsunami happened.
3 years ago, Brettwood Higman heard about a tsunami set off by a landslide. It was so far away from civilization that it was only detected by Columbia University scientists using earthquake monitors. Higman lives with his family in a yurt in Seldovia, off the road system near Homer. He has a PhD in geology, and he's fascinated by tsunamis in the landscape of southeast Alaska. So he started scheming about how he could go take a look.
Sort of dirtbag style, like find, you know, $3,000-$4,000, enough, which, you know, logistics are expensive there, but that'd be enough to get a plane out there, drop me off with my pack raft, go paddle around, dig holes, collect some sand and gravel, and then, you know, I'd figure out what to do next at that point.
The tsunami happened in a place called Tanfjord. The nearest town is Yakutat, population 600, about 60 miles away. And Yakutat itself is way out there. Juneau is another 200 miles to the southeast. Higman figured he should call the two Columbia scientists who first noticed the tsunami. It turned out they were organizing their own expedition and wanted help with logistics from Higman, who's adventured all over Alaska with his wife, author Erin McKittrick. With money from the National Science Foundation, a team of scientists converged on the fjord 2 summers ago. One of them was Peter Heusler, an Anchorage geologist who motored across the Gulf of Alaska on the Alaskan Gyre, a fishing boat turned research vessel.
So it's about a 50-foot converted seiner.
When Heusler got to the fjord, he could see the aftermath of the tsunami. It happened after a gigantic landslide crashed into the water at the toe of the Tyndall Glacier. It sloshed as high as 600 feet above sea level. Heusler says the first thing he noticed is what's called a trim line.
All of the forest that you would normally expect to find up on the mountainside is gone. It's just wiped clean. You're coming in and it's like, I mean, it's just clear there were giant waves on each side of the bay. You definitely think, boy, I'm glad I wasn't here when this was happening.
Some of the scientists looked at the landslide deposits left on shore. One chunk was so big they named it Edgar. Others looked at the path of the tsunami. Heusler's research focused on the landslide remnants that ended up underwater, looking at their size and characteristics. From the boat, he was working to map the ocean floor using technology called multi-beam bathymetry.
It's really neat because the topography on the ocean bottom just reveals itself as you go along so clearly. I mean, you could see, oh, here you're in flat fjord bottom. Here's this blocky stuff that clearly looks like landslide debris.
The goal was to understand the specifics of the landslide and wave to give scientists a better sense of how this kind of event happens. One of the paper's take-home messages is that global warming will make them more likely, since retreating glaciers can leave behind unstable slopes. In Alaska, scientists are thinking about how they should apply the paper's findings to management of public land and water. For Mike Loso, a geologist with Wrangell-St. Elias National Park who worked on the study, the issue is personal. He explains how by talking about Hoof Hill, the spot in the fjord where the water reached its highest point during the wave.
I spent my honeymoon with my wife on Hoof Hill, based out of sea kayaks.
Loso doesn't think it's appropriate to close places like the fjord where the tsunami happened, or other areas where scientists think that there could be risks of similar events, like in Glacier Bay National Park, which is popular with cruise ships. Scientists might not ever understand this type of tsunami well enough to issue warnings or to predict them, and they're not very likely to occur in places where there are people, Loso says. But he does think managers could give out more information about the risks of landslides and tsunamis, even if they're small.
An important role of the Park Service is to allow people to take those risks if they choose to, but we want to make sure they're well informed. So the better we understand these things, the better we can convey those hazards to the public and let them make good decisions, you know, whatever a good decision is for them.
The study is published in the journal Scientific Reports. In Anchorage, I'm Nat Herz.
This summer, cruise ships have been falling afoul of Alaska's air quality standards. As Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports, the industry says it can and will do better.
Susie Cohen has lived and worked in downtown Juneau since the early 90s. So she's used to seeing cruise ships come and go.
This summer, it seems like there's been a lot more pollution in the channel. Some mornings I've woken up and looked out and just seen this heavy blue cloud hanging over the channel, and it's kind of worrisome. You don't know what you're breathing, and it seems like it's coming up into the neighborhoods.
She's among more than 134 people this year who have phoned the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation's cruise ship hotline.
This season, we've received a lot more complaints.
Ed White runs the air quality program for cruise ships at DEC. Some of the calls are about visible steam coming from the ship's stacks.
But we are also receiving more complaints now about things like smell, about the smoke in addition to the steam.
The state's air quality standard for cruise ships is measured by opacity, meaning how see-through the plume coming out of a ship is. Last year, the state collected $75,000 in fines from two ships that violated the standard. This year, it's already sent 9 violation notices for ships in Juneau, Ketchikan, Skagway, Haines, and Seward. One violation can carry a fine of around $46,000, though companies often settle with the state for less. The cruise industry admits it has a problem.
We're disappointed that we are not able to get the visual plume to where we want it to be, and we're committed to continue to work on that to get it there, regardless of what it takes.
That's John Binkley, president of Cruise Lines International Association Alaska. He's addressing civic and business leaders at Southeast Conference in Ketchikan.
It's not good. It does not look good. There's plumes, visible plumes that come out. And we're struggling with that. The engineers are struggling to try and understand why that's happening.
There are multiple reasons for more plumes. DEC's Ed White said one is just plain volume.
A couple of years ago, maybe we'd have 4 ships in. Now we have 6 ships in port. And they're bigger ships as well. We're seeing that as well. So there's more input into the air.
There's also a more technical explanation. 2 years ago, cruise lines installed systems called scrubbers that mix exhaust with water to filter out emissions. Binkley said it was in anticipation of stricter federal sulfur standards.
We're in compliance in terms of the sulfur limits, but we're not happy with the systems, and we're not happy with where we're at in those systems because of the visible emissions.
Ed White said his agency recognizes that its current method of measuring air pollution by opacity has limitations.
Unfortunately, the opacity standard is often more of an indicator where we can look at what that there's smoke present, but knowing what is in that and the potential health risks, that would be something that takes more study and more data.
That's why state regulators are investigating ways to update its methods and possibly the standard itself. In the meantime, coastal residents like Susie Cohen in Juneau said anyone who witnesses apparent cruise ship pollution should speak up.
I think that citizens really need to call when they think that there's a problem. Call into the DEC. They have a hotline, and make sure that you report it.
Alaska continues to grow in popularity with cruise lines. Next year, there's projected to be more than 1.3 million cruise ship passengers, a new all-time record for the third year running. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at Matson.com. Did you know there's no safe amount of alcohol to drink while pregnant? But why should this matter if you're not pregnant or not trying to be? Because nearly half of all pregnancies are unplanned. Many women don't know they're pregnant right away. You could get pregnant and expose your baby to alcohol even before you know you're pregnant. If you're having unprotected sex, don't drink. Learn how FASDs impact everyone, even you, at letstalkfasdak.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
Solar activity is increasing the likelihood of active aurora. University of Alaska Fairbanks Emeritus Professor of Physics and longtime aurora forecaster Charles Deer says this week's activity is one of two mechanisms that drive the aurora.
The first are these huge outbursts that we get during the solar maximum. Now we're on our way down to the minimum. We have the other method, what we call coronal holes. These are high-speed streams of particles that come out from the sun, and it looks like a great big garden sprinkler.
Deer says one hole occurred on Monday and computer modeling predicts a second today or tomorrow. Deer stresses aurora over any region hinge on timing.
Sometimes there's a lot of activity, but it's all over on, say, the other side of the Earth. Our time zone for active aurora is 9 to 12 universal time. The three-hour period where we're at magnetic midnight.
Alaska's magnetic midnight, when the magnetic North Pole is between us and the sun, is between 1 a.m. and 4 a.m. Deer says the current coronal hole activity will continue to increase the likelihood of aurora over the next 4 to 5 days. Brian Brettschneider with our Ask a Climatologist segment is back, and today we talked about the long stretch of sunny weather much of Alaska is experiencing, threatening to break records in some places. Which is kind of funny because the last time we talked, it was the end of a very long period of August rain. Brettschneider says the September days of sun, though, are not only more enjoyable, but more interesting.
We've really flipped a switch. So on August 1st through August 25th, here in Anchorage, we had rain every single day, and that was almost a record. But then it really just, it flipped completely. And since August 26th, here in Anchorage anyway, we've had no measurable precipitation. A couple of sprinkles here and there, but nothing to add up in the rain gauge. And so it's really, really remarkable. I mean, this is our wettest time of the year, and we would expect it to rain about 40% of the days. So to have, you know, we're now up to 17, today's day 18 in a row, and we're a lock to get to 20 days in a row, and perhaps could go a few days longer than that. So it really just is a remarkable stretch of not only dry weather, but sunny weather and warm weather. It's just that combination this time of year is practically unprecedented. Back in 1984, Anchorage went 22 days in a row, starting actually the same date as this year, August 26th, that didn't rain, and it didn't for the next 22 days. And then, so if we can make it to September 16th this year, we would equal that record. They've introduced, I think, 40% chance of rain, starting would be on day 21 and day 22.
So, like all good things, it must come to an end. But let's just dwell in that happy, sunny place for now. Why is that? Why did it set up like that for so long?
This tremendous area of high pressure that, well, in late August, it set up in the Gulf of Alaska, and then it kind of transitioned over into the Bering Sea. And high pressure is areas of sinking air. So when the air sinks, you can't get clouds to form, and without clouds, you can't get any precipitation. And it's just been anchored there for weeks now. And actually, in late August, there was a typhoon that moved up, and that set up this big high pressure on the east side of it. And once you get that dominant pressure system in there, it really makes it hard for the jet stream to kind of push things out of the way. This time of year, though, it's very uncommon to have that kind of blocking pattern.
Is there fallout from that? I mean, is there wildfire danger? I mean, I'm trying to think of like what things might be affected.
In many parts of, say, the lower 48, and I'm thinking, say, in California, they really count on precipitation during their wet time of year. So in that case, it helps fill up the reservoirs. It also, you know, keeps wildfire danger to a minimum. It's a little bit different here in Alaska during the fall season. You know, we generally have a precipitation surplus throughout the year. So we're not a desert, right? We're green. The ground's always wet. Lots of wetlands everywhere. And so we don't really need that precipitation to kind of ecologically sustain it during this time of the year. Now, if we were to have an unusual dry spell, say in April or May or June, then yeah, that's when we would really be concerned about wildfires. But this time of year, not so much, because it's we're getting lower evaporation rates with the lower sun angle, lower temperatures. It's kind of the best of all worlds, really, this time of the year. There's not much of a downside to having a dry spell right now.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist based in Anchorage with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He checks in with Alaska's Energy Desk every other week as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media, and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Nat Herz in Anchorage, and Jacob Resnick in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by Raven Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state, from Valdez, Utqiagvik, and more. Information at flyraven.com. The Trust Fund Land Office annual fall sale is in full swing across Alaska. Revenue generated by the Trust Land Office helps fund local programs for local people. View parcels and learn more at alaskamentalhealthtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.